What is up, fools? This is the QTR Podcast. Today's March 19th, 2020, and it's a special edition of the podcast. First and foremost, my followers know that since last week, I have committed to donating a 50% match to all new patrons to the podcast to the Center for Disaster Philanthropy, or the Center for Philanthropic Disasters, actually. One of the two. I can't remember off the top of my head what it is. COVID-19, they have a relief fund, and so you guys have been coming through in a huge way, which I genuinely appreciate. This podcast is always brought to you by my patrons, who are people that sign up and donate a monthly recurring sum to help support the podcast and support QTR. But over the last week, it looks like so far, we have amassed a donation of over $300 that we will be sending tomorrow. Tomorrow is the cutoff for signing up as a patron and getting a 50% of your donation matched by me. I want to shout out actually some of those people that have donated first, and then I want to shout out some of my longstanding patrons, give you the two rules for the podcast, and we'll be well on our merry way. First and foremost, very special thank you to my friend Matthew Healy, who sent along a donation today. Very much appreciated on PayPal. Half of that is going to be matched and donated. Appreciate you, Matt. Also, Robert Thrash, Tracy Connors, my friend Nick Bradley, Vaclav Kosar, Kemen Linswain, Tom Rimmer, Jeffrey Higgins, Mechatroner, all you guys have signed up of recent, Alejandro Janklevich, Kent, my buddy Thomas Cravey, and Michael Flowers, thank you, James Malloy, Simon, and Taylor Kenny, my friend Namita, David Fiorino, John Bjork, Drew Cuthbert, Michael Lynn, Nicholas Witt, Mark, Travis Rupert, my friends at 10 Strike Racing, my buddy Josh Sebastian, Roberto Moreno, Chris Ariel, my homeboy Andrew Roshko, Chief Shorting Bull, Speedwagon Capital, all you guys coming through in a big way to help support the podcast and help support this COVID-19 relief fund. I'll be posting our cumulative donation tomorrow at some point on Twitter when I get my shit together and get around to it. As always, this podcast is brought to you by my longstanding and largest patrons, the people that keep the wheels to the podcast turning. I want to shout them out, and then we'll get started. First and foremost are my friends over at the Sang Lucci Steam Room. And I didn't know yesterday, actually, or 2 days ago when I talked to Nick Lentz, that he was a Sang Lucci boy, which is pretty cool. Sang Lucci and Charlie Bathgate over at Sang Lucci and Wall Street Jesus do a couple of things. First and foremost, they have the Sang Lucci Steam Room, which is a real-time online chat room that is going to show you steam coming into the options market, which many times is indicative of where money is going to go in the equities market, especially now with the volatility in the markets. You want to know when big boys step in and start to throw around some big boy capital, and there's no better way to stay on top of that than with Sang Lucci's Steam Room. Sang Lucci also offers, and by the way, he's the best at doing this. These guys have been doing it longer than anybody else, any other service. He is the best, and I know him personally, and I trust him, so he's a good guy to do business with. He also offers, by the way, his 3LT playbook, which are the three rules that he has used to make himself a seven-figure trader. I've seen the P&L. He posted on Instagram. It's no bullshit. And also his Sang Lucci Master Course, which is an educational course that he offers in regular guy lingo, not bullshit finance lingo, so it's easy to understand what the hell he's talking about. Links to those are in my podcast description. This podcast also brought to you by another honest man doing his own thing that got sick of the system and sick of the bullshit, Pete Hegedus over at The Trader's Path. Pete is a longtime supporter of the podcast and started The Trader's Path, which is an investing community, because Pete belonged to a bunch of investing slash day trading communities and basically found out that they were all bullshit. He was getting front run. He didn't like the guys that were running them. He felt like he was just, you know, people were taking his money and basically just leaving him. And so he said, you know what, I'm going to start my own thing. Not unlike the way I started the podcast. And Pete offers all different types of things. He offers a daily watch list of what stocks he's looking at. He offers a community to speak with and a live stream, investor education. He trades all different kinds of markets, red, green, up, down, left, right, whatever. And, you know, it's generally in these times now where things are this volatile, it's always very good to have a little bit of an extra community around you, extra ideas, extra people to bounce things off of. And so if you're a day trader, the trader's path might be worth having a look at. The link to that is also in my podcast description. Tell Pete I sent you, and tell him I said you want a discount. Otherwise, you're not coming over, and he's going to give you a discount because I know Pete, and that's how he works. This podcast also brought to you by my longstanding supporters and other wonderful individuals at Rumorhound. Rumorhound is a very unique piece of software. There's nothing like it, okay? What does Rumorhound do? It is an artificial intelligence-based proprietary piece of software that examines merger and acquisition rumors as they happen in real time. You see them on Twitter, you see them on CNBC, you see them in chat rooms. It looks at a whole group of proprietary financial and different types of variables regarding these proposed transactions, and it spits back to you in very easy to read terminology whether or not it is a merger or an acquisition you may want to pay attention to. So not unlike options flow, mergers and acquisitions, an area you can make a lot of money if you have good information. So Rumorhound offers all of this up in a beautiful looking platform. It's very easy on the eye, and there's nobody that does anything like it. They're offering a free 14-day trial if you sign up through my podcast description. So you sign up, try it for 13 days, you don't like it, you don't owe them anything, but also another great tool to have in your arsenal if you are a day trader. And if you want a discount, tell them, quote the Raven said, you want a discount and you're not signing up without one, and they can go throw rocks unless they give you a discount, and I guarantee you they're going to give you a discount. That's how we roll. There's something that they're supposed to be, 10% off or whatever. Just tell them, quote the Raven sent you, and that you want a discount or you're walking away, and they can speak to me about it. Good guys, though. All honest businesses that I have no problem recommending. This podcast also brought to you by my friends Corvus Gold. Man, gold is out of stock right now everywhere I look. Check out my friends at CorvusGold.com. Monero, the Investors Underground, Nathan Michaud over there. Another great day trading community. Chris Boas, Ken R., Chris Bede, Nicholas Parks, Matthew Zimmer, shipping analyst Jay Mintzmeyer, my homeboy Russ Valenti, my brother Crichton Titus, who I actually just spoke to today for a moment. And who else? Good question, asshole. You should have the list up here, but you don't. So I'm going to give you the two rules to the podcast first, and then I'm going to go back to that. 2-drink minimum. Folks, you're quarantined at home. The outbreak is making this as easy as possible for you. I've recommended a 2-drink minimum since I started the podcast. Long before other people have been doing their various shows and recommending getting drunk, it is a time-tested rule that we have put to work for a long time here, and I highly recommend it. And so it should be easy now that you're locked down at the house. Hopefully you stocked up on booze. Also, listen, I am not a financial advisor. This is not financial advice. My guest is not a financial advisor. This is not financial advice. We hold no registrations. We hold no licenses. Please do your research elsewhere. Real quick, Dylan Davis, Ken, J.K. Cunningham, Stank Love, and my homeboy Brainerd Ferguson, along with Matt Merle, Chris, and Santo. All right, Sam Pearson, you're the last one. Let's get started with today's podcast. With me on the line today is, man, if you're a Tesla skeptic, you probably know his Twitter account. He is at Tesla Charts, calling from his underground bunker somewhere, wherever he may lie. It is a mystery, and we are okay with that. And also the host of TC's Chartcast, which if you are tuning in because you like to hear about Tesla, especially if you're a skeptic, make sure you check out TC's Chartcast as well, because his podcast is filling in a big gap where mine doesn't, which is it really goes deep on Tesla. We talk about it a little bit here, but he's just decided to run with it. So, Mr. TC, hello, and congratulations on the success of your podcast, brother.
Thanks, Chris. It's great to be back on. It's been too long. Thanks for allowing me to make a little plug on the podcast, TC's Chartcast, as you said, inspired by my appearances on your show and on my friend's show, Dimitri Kafonis, over at Hidden Forces. And as you said, we go deep on Tesla. I've got a great co-host, George Orwell, and our sound engineer, Evacuation Boy, and our in-house poet, Pulse Tesla. It's a lot of fun. It's meant to be sort of deep dive with really smart people, but also a lot of humor, and we're having a blast. So 16 episodes in, and as again, you know, it's thanks to Chris Irons in no small part. So really appreciate it.
Wow. All right. Well, hopefully when you go huge, I'll be getting a cut of the royalty checks. You said, yeah. Go ahead.
No, it's absolutely. You can have as big a cut of zero as you want, because right now we're ad-free. So.
Well, I tell you what, sometimes zero isn't zero. I mean, look at Tesla's equity, right? Mm.
Indeed. We're going to IPO TC's Charcast. Big growth projections.
Giant growth projections, big top-line growth, and just pay attention to nothing else. By the way, you're drinking wine, you just told me a minute ago.
I am.
I'd like to know what you're drinking.
I'm drinking Kim Crawford Sauvignon Blanc, which is the table wine of TC's Charcast. Unsponsored, but still, we'll put a plug in for it. It's a good wine from New Zealand.
Are you a big wine guy?
I'm a big volume wine guy.
Like, you drink a lot of it?
Yeah, I've stored a lot for the coming apocalypse, so I figured I got to rotate the stock.
I have as well. Are you like, do you get pompous with it though? Like, are you super into it?
Oh, no.
Like, can you talk vineyards?
No.
Can you talk?
No.
Can you talk grapes? You know the difference between the grapes? I mean, you know what you're looking for when you pop open a Sauvignon Blanc versus a Cabernet?
No, I come from more modest upbringings than that would imply. And for example, my beer of choice is Coors Light, and I fully intend about halfway through this podcast to crack open one of those. Once I find a wine that I like, I just buy it in volume. No, I'm not a wine connoisseur. I got nothing against wine connoisseurs. They're often great dinner mates, but I buy wine by the case, not the bottle.
Yeah, nothing goes good with a nice Sauvignon Blanc like an ice cold Coors Light, you know.
and a QTR podcast appearance.
A sommelier told me that somewhere. Do you know what the difference between having sex in a canoe and Coors Light is, or what the fuck? I already fucked that up. Hang on.
Well, I've done one of those two things, so I'm curious to see what the difference is.
What is the joke? It's like, what's the same about having sex in a canoe and Coors Light? They're both fucking close to water.
Well, like I say, I'm one out of two. I can verify the Coors Light claim.
Lovely. All right. And don't feel like you have to class it up either, because I'm sitting here next to a half-drank $6 bottle of brandy. So good. We'll slum it up and we'll talk some Tesla. How does that sound?
Sounds great.
All right. First off, Elon Musk is right now, as we speak, according to press reports, negotiating. For some reason, the Fremont police feel the need to negotiate with him as to why he should be allowed to have his factory open in the midst of arguably the worst pandemic in modern history, at least over the last 100 years, where his county, Alameda County, has issued a mandatory lockdown order where businesses have to close except for essential businesses. Yet CEO Numbnuts is somehow still has 2,500 people in his Fremont plant right now. And you know, he is keeping production going while at the same time, he's telling the New York City mayor, Bill de Blasio, another Mensa candidate, that he is going to be producing ventilators for New York City. What the fuck is going on? That's my first question.
It's really amazing, Chris. And let me correct you on one minor point, but it's important. It's not 2,500, it's 10,000. They have agreed.
Well, they agreed to
theory,
they agreed to come down to 2,500, right?
Well, this is a classic Musk move. There's no date associated with that. They've agreed to step down to 2,500. The Shorty Air Force photographs from today show a very full employee parking lot. Snapchat stories from inside the factory, which is a wonderful sort of public data collection tactic that Tesla Q has developed, shows pictures of, you know, people eating next to each other in crowds in the cafeteria and no social distancing whatsoever. It is really amazing. So let's maybe fill in some of the details for the audience members that aren't following the story as closely as we are. Not just Alameda County, but the six major counties surrounding San Francisco have gone into a shelter-in-place lockdown a couple of days ago, ostensibly because they have a substantial outbreak in the coronavirus. There's lots of controversy as to whether or not our response to this virus is appropriate, and I'm sure you and I will get into that. But ultimately, the people with the most data and the most responsibility for the health and well-being of the citizens of the San Francisco Bay Area decided that the data they were seeing triggered their responsibility to take drastic action. And it's very clear that making luxury electric vehicles isn't an essential business. The spirit and I think letter of the order says it's things like gas stations and grocery stores and hospitals, the things that you truly need to persist during a shelter in place. And it, from all, you know, observations and from what I could tell, Elon Musk has decided that he knows better and he's above the law and he has just outright ignored the order. People are still going to work. They're still making cars. The sheriff has said it is illegal for them to be making cars. He's ignored that. They're producing cars today, according to several observations that I trust that I've seen. And then he flew out of town. So he got on his private jet and flew back to Brownsville, where the SpaceX facility is in Texas. And there's, you know, 10,000 people in close proximity to each other in the middle of a pandemic who basically have to go to work. And by the way, I feel for these workers. Nobody has anything but sympathy for these workers from two angles. I mean, there's no question that this job is really important to them and they need to work and they need to make money. And on top of that, they're exposing themselves and their families to potentially serious health risk because they need that money. And it's not like there isn't a historical culture of intimidation and retaliation against whistleblowers or people who defy Elon Musk. And so they know if they don't go, they're not going to get paid or they're likely to get fired when all this blows over and nobody's looking. So they go. And I have nothing but enormous empathy for the plight of these workers who don't get to go on a private jet and fly across the country.
Right.
You know, they have to actually go in there and you know, if imagine if you're a middle class person who has a job at Fremont that you really need and you happen to have an elderly parent living with you that is in a high risk group.
Yeah.
And you have to go to work now with 10,000 other people. How can it be that in America in 2020, Elon Musk gets to decide to completely ignore the law? And then now we see, you know, that the Fremont Police Department tweeted this afternoon that they're negotiating with factory leadership over their obeying the shutdown order.
There's no negotiation like I just tweeted. The negotiation should go like this. Shut the fucking thing down or you're going to jail. Negotiation over right there. But for some reason, this guy gets to just... And it's been like this. It was like this with Vern Unsworth. It was like this with bailing out Solar City. It was like this with committing securities fraud. For some reason, we just keep giving this guy a pass. And it's
worse than that. Bill de Blasio is on Twitter going full Bill Ackman, begging Elon Musk to build, you know, medical equipment to help the city out.
What does that tell you about Bill de Blasio?
Well, you know, our good mutual friend Aaron Greenspan just put a brilliant tweet out, which is, it's really amazing that after fleecing the state of New York to the tune of $1 billion,
right,
Elon still has the full faith and trust of the mayor of the city of New York.
It's fucking insane. It tells you how stupid people are, is what it does.
It's just crazy. So I mean, think this forward.
They have assigned this idea to him. You know, it happened years ago that he is the end-all, be-all savior of the human race for some reason. And everybody that buys into that, like when he goes on Joe Rogan and Joe Rogan is just sniffing his throne, you know, and I love Joe Rogan, right? But like everybody that buys into it and continues, all the media outlets that put out this morning the lead, the headline, Elon Musk commits to making ventilators for people. You know, when he tweets out Elon Musk is going to fix the Flint water crisis, which, by the way, he never did. You know, all the people that continue to do that are making this worse. By the way, just to go back to what you were saying about middle-class people working at the factory, and shit, do I feel for them too. But also, I read yesterday in Business Insider, I believe it was Business Insider, that if people want to take off because they have the coronavirus or they fear having the coronavirus or they're sick, they have to use their paid time off. And if they run out of paid time off, they have to borrow more from the company, which means the company will give them paid time off, but they're going to be expected to repay that back to the company. Isn't that nice? Isn't that a nice thing to do for your employees?
Yeah, it's really crisis defines character. And right, we're in the middle of a crisis and we're getting a front row seat to the man's character. Anybody can lead during the good times. The only opportunity to differentiate yourself as a leader is in a crisis. And we're seeing right now what matters to him. And, you know, it really is a strange flex for him to make at this time. It can't be that Q1 demand is so robust that he needs to keep producing. He's just making cars and putting them in inventory at this point because the rest of the world is shutting down. I don't know what's going on. It's either there's lots of sort of theories on the sort of financial shenanigans side, which we don't need to get into, or it could just be that he's just stubborn and he's not going to take orders from anybody, certainly not some little county sheriff out in Alameda County, and he's going to show the sheriff who's boss because nobody just gets to come to his factory and shut it down. But let's do this thought experiment. Let's imagine that a large cluster of coronavirus victims, basically, outbreaks on the floor. And believe me, I'm not wishing for that because they're all going to go home and infect everybody else. And they're going to basically cause what the county was trying to do to be completely nullified. What is the legal responsibility that he is personally and the company is, you know, in total accruing because of this boneheaded decision to openly defy a plain order from the county sheriff? So imagine that 200-400 people out of those 10,000 become infected with the disease, and heaven forbid a half a dozen or a dozen of them pass away from it. I don't know what the board of directors is thinking. Like, how can it be that the whim of one man can put the whole franchise at jeopardy? You're talking 2 or 3 weeks, shut it down, match demand to inventory. You're going to get relief from the government. The whole point of what Trump is trying to do, and I believe he's sincere, is people like those workers shouldn't have to choose between a paycheck and their health. Send them home and give them the money. The government's going to be there to help. There was a high road to be taken here, and he clearly decided not to do it. And it is amazing. Amazing. It's just, you can't make this up.
It's outrageous.
Chris.
It's outrageous behavior is what it is.
You can't make it up.
In
you
my opinion.
Can't make it up.
And, you know, look, to go to your point, I don't understand what the liability would be in a situation like this where, if somebody unfortunately there, I mean, you know how I feel about the coronavirus. I feel like it's probably been everywhere and is everywhere already, and it's just the testing that's just revealing the numbers. I was just watching an interview on London Real with this conspiracy theorist. I didn't agree with a lot of what he said, but he had said that, you know, in December or January, him and his son had fallen ill and they had the exact same set of symptoms. You know, and now he's left wondering, like, did we have it already? And, you know, I had a fever, I think, back in December or January also, too. And I wonder the same thing. I wonder, like, man, did I have this? And then, you know, did we just pass it on yet? But, I mean, I don't know what, if that's not the case, or if people have it and it's just getting passed around or whatever, what does the liability become for him for openly defying this order? And, you know, it's not just potentially harmful to his employees, who I feel for, but it's potentially, like you said, harmful to the people around them, you know? Like, go ahead.
Chris, I'm on day 7 of a very well-planned, thorough quarantine in my immediate circle. And I view it as my civic duty. I have young children, which is my primary driver. But also, I recognize that, according to the data, my impression is that this disproportionately affects the elderly population and people with pre-existing conditions. I could be a carrier and not know it and ultimately be responsible for somebody else's death. Now, here's the most important thing. That's not our decision to make. It has been determined by authorities in the San Francisco Bay Area that a shelter-in-place order was necessary. They have more data than me and you sitting here spitballing, you know, on a podcast. They have real-time data with constant communication with the hospitals. They know what the capacity of their intensive care unit is. They see the rate of cases coming in that require ICU admission. They are implementing what they believe with all of their data and their authority is the very best decision for the health and well-being of the counties that they're responsible for. And this one guy gets to decide to nullify all of that, because if 10,000 people are congregating in close proximity to each other on a daily basis, and many of them are carriers of the disease and are asymptomatic, it is almost inevitable that this one decision that he made is going to cause a substantial issue in the Bay Area. And who's going to hold him accountable for it? And by the way, it's not even close. He has been ordered to shut down, and he just said, no. What are you going to do about it? Who makes the laws in this country? Elon Musk?
Yeah, I don't know. It's, and then you bring up the question about why. And this is another interesting thing. Why insist on producing? Like you said, the demand isn't there, right? Because everything's shut down. Demand for everything has just fallen off of a cliff. Let's say the demand was there prior to this. But demand for, nobody's going out and buying luxury vehicles now. You know, nobody's going out and really buying anything right now. Nobody's really going out, except for this dude's employees. So why is it necessary for these things to roll off the line so they can go be stored in a parking lot somewhere? And I thought, when I first thought about this, that to me what made sense was because so much of the stock sentiment is driven on the deliveries number and on the top line. I mean, nobody's given a shit about profitability all along with this company. So why would they start caring now? Nobody's given a shit about fundamentals or multiple to this point with this company. So if the main metric that's holding up the share price is deliveries and production numbers and meeting your production estimates, I mean, does he think that it's that important that he hit those numbers? Even when the whole world, by the way, like look at Volkswagen. I just saw shutting down their factory, right? General Motors is laying people off. Ford is shutting down. Like, these are other legit, like, not other legit, but these are legitimate automobile companies. These are the, like, best practices, the companies with best practices in the industry. And they're all shutting down. So what is that nagging reason that he, I mean, it could just be stubbornness, like you're saying. He could just be like, you know, I'm the law in this town, and I say when we shut down. But he was also out and called this a cold. He called it a cold.
I think that's it. So honestly, there are more sort of conspiratorial interpretations that one could go down, and several have online, where you sort of think about, you know, the accounts receivable and how's he going to explain the accounts receivable hole not closing if they have a big drop in deliveries. Maybe he made some promises to suppliers in the miracle quarter in Q3 2019, where on flat deliveries, net income rose $500 million, which is very difficult to explain. And maybe those promises for rebates in that quarter were tied to volume commitments in 2020 that if he doesn't hit, he's going to be in big trouble. Right. But none of that matters. All of that could have been washed away with A, him taking the high road, and B, him being totally transparent with everybody saying, hey, look, 50% of our deliveries come in the last 3 weeks of the quarter. We're going to have a really bad quarter because of that. We believe this is just going to be demand slippage from Q1 to Q2. We just raised $2.3 billion from the equity markets. Our liquidity position is bulletproof. We're here. We're going to do the right thing by our employees, and we're taking the high road, and this is very serious, and we want to lead by example to show the rest of the country that you should respect what the president has asked us to do, which is to social distance from one another and to, you know, protect your family first.
The president, not his local congressperson, the leader charts. Of the free world, right?
Yeah. So my point was, if he had taken the high road from the beginning, he could have delivered 10,000 cars in Q1 and have been forgiven for it. Right. He would have been praised for it.
Right.
Good for you. You sacrificed a little bit. Everybody gets it. Like, nobody's blaming the CEO of Delta for the fact that demand has collapsed 90% in the airline industry. Everybody gets it. Now, look, the stock's taken a beating, but that's the way the world works. Equities go down sometimes.
Like, right.
it's not Delta's CEO's fault. I would say Boeing is a different story. They kind of put themselves in this position, but you know, there's no question. Look, Elon claims to have $6 billion in cash and just raised another 2.3. There was a high road to be taken and he didn't. So then you have to ask yourself why. I think Occam's Razor says his early tweet where he said coronavirus panic is dumb boxed him into a corner,
right?
And he doesn't want to come out of it. So he would rather be right. He would rather be right than to follow or to submit to a higher authority. And it turns out the kind of personality that just is utterly, utterly rebellious against all authority whatsoever is a very dangerous one. And I've been very harsh on him, his story, and I think I'm being proven right. My only hope is that this outrageous and flagrant defiance of a black and white order from the authorities at the most critical time in our country's history, for at least the last 10, 20 years, you know, since 9/11, this is probably the biggest crisis the country has faced. Whether or not the response to the virus,
this is a global crisis.
Yeah. And whether or not the response is appropriate, it's coming. It's a tsunami. Like, we're in for a lot of dislocation in society. For this guy to pick this fight at this time for this reason is stupefying.
Yeah, it is fascinating. It really is. It's outrageous and it's sad. And you know, when he came out and said that the panic is dumb, I mean, look, you and I obviously have both been preparing for this for a while. You know, we both probably knew for months that this was going to be a major issue. And, you know, I felt similarly when the president said in mid-February, you know, hey, we got 15 cases and it's going to zero. It's like, fucking no, it isn't, you know, like, and there's not shit that you're going to be able to say. There's not anything the Fed's going to be able to do that's going to stop the data that is going to come out over the next month or two. And that's why I said I think Trump's going to lose the election in November, because by then we will have had millions of cases globally, and the Democrats are going to replay that clip of him. We got 15 cases and it's going to zero. We got 15 cases and it's going to zero. You know, and at the same time, how fucking stupid is Elon Musk's tweet? Not only the one where he calls it a cold, but the one where he says the panic is dumb. How stupid is that going to look? Yet he is allowed to continue to make remarks like that, do things like what he did to Vern Unsworth, do things that he, you know, did to Skabushka, do all these things where he never really faces any consequences. You know what I said to you on the phone the other day? He's making a lot of karmic withdrawals, and at some point he's going to be overdrawn, right? I mean, it feels like that.
So let's be clear. Nobody was harder on the president than me that day where he said 15 going to zero. We both knew that was complete BS.
I was harder than you.
Yeah. Yeah. Nobody's been there. Yeah. But I would say this. To his credit, he pivoted.
He sure did.
And, you know, I'm a patriotic American. I respect the office. I want the country to get through this. I'm prepared for it to the best that I can. And we could talk about that. And we could talk about the virus and why you and I were a little bit early on it, I think, relative to the rest. But to Trump's credit, after he saw, I think, the disastrous response to Jerome Powell cutting rates to zero and basically launching another QE, I think that shook him straight.
Yeah.
Which tells me that he is capable of being shook and straight. I don't think Elon is.
Interesting.
Like, well, I there's a difference between the two that's real. And since that day, I would give Trump high marks for the presidential nature of his press conferences, the things he's trying to communicate. A certain amount of cheerleading is fine, and that's what you want from the commander-in-chief. But there is a vast difference between the pivot that Trump has made once he realized, you know, man, I think I was really wrong and I screwed up, and I'm not sure that he's going to lose the election. He's still got time. And it's not like the competition is so overwhelming at this point. But for Elon, I mean, it's an odd flex. It really is bold flex, you know, to be overtly disobeying the local authorities. And again, just think about the risk. He thinks he knows better. What if he's wrong? He's put the whole company at risk. If 500 people get sick at that factory, it's done for Tesla. It just is. Run that thought experiment. How do you explain that? And by the way, I don't want it to happen. I don't necessarily think it'll happen, but it could happen.
Right.
Where's the risk management? Where is the adult in the room to say, Elon, enough?
Risk management? What company are you talking about?
Yeah, I guess so.
What company are you talking about? Risk management?
I'm only on my first drink. I'm sorry. I'm not on my game yet.
You know, I was like, I said the same shit after he called Vern Unsworth a pedo. I was like, where's the board of directors? You know, if it was Mary Barra that said that, she would have been out the next day. If it was Satya Nadella, he would have been out the next day. Right? No.
Well, they,
he's got fucking, what's her name, Denholm, you know, saying, I think he uses Twitter effectively. And you want to talk about risk management?
You're right. My bad. My bad. I live in this utopian fantasy where, you know, decisions have consequences. My bad.
So let's talk about something else, too. Since the last time you were on, the stock went from 300 to almost 1,000 and is now back down to trading with a 400 handle. And I want to address one thing. Actually, I think Spiegel was the last Tesla guy I had on. And a lot of people were giving me shit when the stock was, you know, 700, 800, 900, saying, you know, how come you're not talking about Tesla anymore? How come you don't have any Tesla people on? You're avoiding it, this, that, and the other. And the truth of the matter is I was not avoiding it. I had actually asked several people to come on. Several people said no. I didn't want to bring Spiegel right back on because I had just had him on. But I had been hounding Montana Skeptic to come back on. I really wanted to hear from him when the stock was at 800, 900. And I was just couldn't get anybody to come back on and couldn't get a schedule to work. And it's nobody's fault. But I certainly wasn't avoiding it. But now here we are kind of in the aftermath of things. And the stock has again dropped $500. So what did I miss in your life when the stock tripled and went to $1,000? Oh, here it is. Tesla to temporary suspend production of Fremont.
I'm looking at a series of 15 red headlines on the Bloomberg terminal. Yep. So I do intend to address that question, but I just want to, for the audience, Tesla has decided to temporarily suspend production in Fremont. It looks like Tesla has put out an operational update, you know, decided to also, looks like New York. Are you seeing the same headline that they're going to stop operations in New York? And it's talking about available credit lines. So it looks like they have basically decided to shut production in Fremont and have updated the market on their liquidity situation.
Hey.
And the stock is dropping a little bit. It's currently quoted at 410, and it was as high as 445 this afternoon. So we'd be remiss if we didn't at least address that.
Yeah, congratulations.
I take no pleasure from it.
Not to you. I'm talking to Elon and the Fremont Police Department. Oh,
good for them, yeah. And then they said another headline just came. They're going to implement touchless deliveries to try to get as many cars delivered at the end of the quarter. And that's fine. They should. They should.
How are you going to touchlessly deliver a car?
Well, they're going to drive it to your driveway and drop it off and not give you a chance to inspect it. That's the key part of the touchless delivery. And then run away and be sure to charge your credit card in advance. No, I'm just kidding. So to your question.
And how much and add on to that question, how much of a donkey does he feel like for not raising $20 billion in capital while the stock's at $150 billion valuation? Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah. I don't know that he could have, to be honest with you. I think
he could have raised more than $2 billion.
I don't know that he could have. I think he raised all he could, but that's a separate question. Let's talk first about the, I believe the technical phrase that you use is the assholing that Tesla Q received from 300 to 950. I would say there's no question about it that was a very difficult time for anybody who was short the stock, me included. Many of my friends lost a lot of money. I'm clearly not happy about it, primarily for my own, but also for the people that I've gotten to know and care about. That run-up, when the history of that run-up is written, I'll be very curious to read it. There was an awful lot of activity in the options market that I think is pretty questionable.
Yeah, there was.
But that notwithstanding, I personally did okay. First of all, it was never really a huge and still isn't a huge investment for me. I've said before on Twitter and I've said on your show, this is primarily a sort of anti-fraud campaign with a small investment attached to it as opposed to a substantial investment. But I did have I kind of got lucky and I was annoyed but it turns out in hindsight it was a blessing. I really got screwed on the Q3 earnings report, where he produced, as I mentioned earlier, a $500 million incremental improvement in underlying net income on basically flat deliveries, which is really quite unbelievable. But he did, and the stock ripped. I think it ripped like $60, $70 after hours and another $40 or $50 the next day. And a lot of people really got their face ripped off, including me. I had a very, very good friend who's a really great trader and a really great technical guy. And just before earnings, he and I were chatting, and he said, you know, TC, I'm not playing this earnings. I'm covering my short. I don't like the setup, and I'm not going to trade it. And that kind of spooked me a little bit, so I took some off. I was still short, but then I got screwed by my broker. It was classic sort of rookie trading mistake, and I'm not afraid to admit it. I did a calendar call spread to try to capture some implied volatility decay after earnings, and as part of that, I was sort of long one call and short the other at different dates. And when the stock flew through the roof, the short call triggered a margin issue, even though I had the you know, offsetting long call. But right. Because they were different dates, my long sitting off call wasn't included in the margin calculation for my requirements. And so then I got hit with a margin call, which is fine.
Because you had the liquidity, right?
Well, they said I had time to give them the liquidity, and I was in the process of doing it, and they forced closed my position with terrible execution at the open, where the bid ask spreads on the options were crazy wide. And so even though my position was actually winning, I was in the money, I got a terrible bid and a terrible ask closing out the positions, and I ended up losing a small amount of money. But it pissed me off, as you can imagine.
Been there.
Yeah, you know, when you're long a call option and they fill you, you know, below the bid, I got filled at less than it was in the money.
Yeah, and that and that's exactly like what happens in those situations where you get a call and they have to just blow it out, and they do it, like you said, in a super illiquid, you know, everything's fucked. That first 5 minutes of options trading is a disaster.
Yeah. Yeah, and I got screwed. Everyone's gone through it. I'm not ashamed of it. I'm the first to admit it. So my loss wasn't actually on the trade. It was on the forced execution in a wide, thin, liquid market. Bid-ask spreads were blown out. And I got made fun of by all of my friends in the business, which is fine. So after that, I still had some long-term puts, and I've always been short Tesla via put options. But I took a break. I was like, you know, there's something wrong. Like, if you could just do that, if you just make up numbers, I think, what am I doing? I got no edge. So I'm just going to watch and keep running Tesla charts. And I still had my short position. But the good thing about a short position via put options is you're range bound by zero. Right. So as it went from like 400 to 900, it's not like it went from zero to more zero.
Right.
It just sort of just stayed at zero. And ironically, those same puts, because they were long dated, are back in play and doing pretty well. But a lot of people lost the money on that run up. But my trader friend, and if he's listening, he knows who he is, but I won't name him. He was very brilliant. He dodged that bullet, and then he just wouldn't get back in. And I would talk to him, you know, every once in a while, say, how you doing? What are you thinking? Where do you think the stock is? And he's not ready yet. It's not ready yet. It's not ready yet. And then we had that blow off top at 960. And when it peaked at 960, there was like a 15-minute window at the end of a trading day where it dropped like $120.
Yeah, I remember
just
that.
Just cratered. It was amazing. I was sitting here watching the Bloomberg terminal. I've never seen a stock go so vertical in the down direction so quickly. And that kind of felt really like the top. And now it's just been an amazing trading sardine. It's just ping-ponging everywhere. And even though the implied volatility options are out of control, the stock swings so wildly that if you're just patient, if you don't get your timing right. I've learned a lot from a lot of people on Twitter, and I'm not a trader, but I'm becoming better at it. And things like position size and risk management, putting in your sell orders when you make the trade so that you don't get greedy and piggish. You know, hey, if a double happens, I should sell it. There's always going to be another trade. There's going to be another opportunity tomorrow. I've gotten a lot better at it, and I've been very much enjoying the ride down from 900 to where we are right now, which is right around 400. That's been much more pleasant than the ride up from 300 to 900. And so luckily for me, the time period in which we went from 300 to 900 versus the reverse, I've gotten better over time, I think, with sort of strategy and tactics. And so overall, it's been certainly a very poor return on my time, but it hasn't really crushed me financially like it has some others, and certainly feel bad about that, because I don't think that run from 300 to 900 was based on any fundamentals whatsoever. And in fact, it's very easy to make the case that the business fundamentals are way worse now than they were back in December when the stock was in that 300 range.
Yeah, it was definitely interesting. I remember after that first surprise profit earnings report, there was just wave after wave after wave of serious call option buying. Every time I have several different option alert services that I use. My buddy Sang Lucci has a room where he calls out options activity. And it was just every day, you know, with the stock at 400, it was every day that I was seeing millions coming into, 2021 on the 700 strike, 2021 on the 800 strike, October on the 600 strike. And we're sitting down at 400, and I'm just like, whoa, like that's real steam coming into. And I think I tweeted about it a couple of times as well. Mm-hmm. And that's why, you know, when I talked to Spiegel around then and privately, not on the podcast, talked to a very good friend of mine who I speak with daily. And he was asking me, what should I do for earnings? I'm saying, I don't know. Like, I would just avoid it at this point because it just seems...
So hot.
Hot, right, is a good word, man. But to see that steam come into those super high strikes, like the 800... I remember it was at 400. I was watching money pile into the $800 strikes. Millions of dollars. And I'm like, what is going on here? That's why I actually tweeted a couple of times, too, that I thought maybe they had a partnership. I thought maybe there was, I've been watching options flow for almost a decade now. I've been watching the market pretty much daily for almost a decade now. You get a pretty good feel for when there's news out there that hasn't been released. And that's what it felt like to me. It felt like they had did a partnership with Volkswagen, or Apple had taken a stake, or Buffett was coming in or something, because there was just that much steam. It wasn't just a fund somewhere saying, oh, I'll take a shot, or Cathie Wood upping her position. It wasn't like that. It was real steam. So baffling. I'd be interested to know what the hell happened there.
I suspect there are potentially more nefarious interpretations as to what transpired. I'm very grateful to that friend who dodged the bullet, and to my broker for screwing me over on that trade, because it allowed me to take a pause. And then once I took the pause and I saw the same options flow that you were seeing, it was amazing. There's nothing about the fundamentals of Tesla's business. In fact, I would argue they got worse, because there's not going to be any robotaxis this year. Autopilot deaths continue to pile up.
Robotaxis.
I'll give you a break. Which will you take the over on? Number of robotaxis or number of ventilators he makes?
Yo, but it doesn't fucking matter, because nobody calls him out on his lies.
Like, I do think
no one calls him out on this shit.
I guess, and believe me, there isn't a person on the planet that doesn't know and live and experience that more than me, and I can't believe I'm still here in 2020 talking to you about Tesla. But in the end, as I've said over and over again, the guy doesn't create economic value. He torches capital. And we're heading into and maybe we could pivot to the virus and prepping and the potential economic impacts as we see it on a go-forward basis. But if we're heading into a tsunami, I don't know how a toxic balance sheet, no growth, low margin, low-quality producer of automobiles that require government subsidies for demand creation can survive. And by the way, I bet you he's wishing that he had, induced conversion on a lot of the convert debt that he has on the balance sheet.
That's
when the
what
stock
I'm
was
saying.
Sitting at $700, $800, $900.
That's what I'm saying.
There were lots of ways to raise. And by the way, the market would have cheered that. Good for you. I, of course, would have been shareholder dilution, but these shareholders are – these shareholders are the biggest bunch of, you know, that give it to me Elon types that you'll ever meet. I mean, everything can be cheered with this guy. And so, you know, if he had basically, he could have cleaned up the balance sheet at $700-$800.
He had reached escape velocity, as somebody wrote. I don't know where I read that, but he could have reached escape velocity, right? If your equity valuation goes to $150 billion, all you have to do, and I said this on Twitter, and you're saying the same thing now, tidy up the balance sheet, take care of all the debt, convert all the convertibles. He could have cleaned up the balance sheet and put a fucking war chest together. He could be sitting on $15 billion in cash, and he could have acquired a cash-generating company all at the same time. He could have issued stock, you know, when it was at $900, he could have issued stock at $625 to go out and acquire. He could have acquired fucking General Motors if he wanted to, you know? But right now, here we are. And you can't do anything now, Mr. Charts, because now you look like the ultimate fucking donkey. The only thing I see possibly happening is, you know, if this thing gets back down to 100 or 150, you know, somebody may be stepping in with a dilutive lifeline, you know, to invest in the brand equity at this point. But who the fuck knows?
Well, he certainly didn't help his brand equity with this performance. But to circle back to the conversation about whether or not that run up from 300 to close to 1,000 was legitimate. Look what happened today. We ran 24% in the stock today, and now it's, you know, catching a bid as low as 391 after hours, down from 445. I mean, was that run up today natural? I know the market was up today, but there was just relentless buying today, pushing, you know, basically steamrolling anybody in the way all day. And then boom, of course, by total coincidence, announces the big turd, files an 8K, and tells the world that basically he's shutting down indefinitely. And now the stock is selling off. Like, this is a classic Elon move. It's sort of pump bad news and then end up slightly higher than.
Well, we don't know that. Yeah, we don't know that he pumped the stock today, though. I mean, to me, I was watching I have my Tesla window right next to the S&P futures window. I mean, it looked like it was moving with the market today. Plus, that 350 is a big technical level, so I'm not like super surprised to see it bounce, because you got a lot of people that look at charts and play connect the dots that trade this stock too.
I don't know. I think a 25% move was a little bit more than market.
Well, yeah. I mean,
and it wouldn't have moved 25% if they'd known he was going to shut down basically all of his factories. So I don't know. It's interesting. I'm not accusing it. It's just, you know, when the long term story of this is written, just yet another day, another footnote, you know, as to what's actually going on here. There's certainly. It is amazing. This thing is still selling at 4x revenue today. People think, oh, it's off from 1,000. 1,000 is anchoring. It's an automaker that loses money, that's selling at 4x revenue, that has enormous liabilities. Autopilot is not an asset, it's a liability. Elon is not an asset, he's a liability. You got the SolarCity lawsuit out there, the 420 lawsuit out there. Like, this is not, it's insane at $390, which is the bid I'm looking at right now. That's still 4x revenue, assuming revenue doesn't collapse. GM is selling at 0.2x revenue, 0.3x revenue. It's still 10 times the price of its peers up here at 390. It's amazing.
It is something else, I'll tell you that. It is definitely something else. And
so that thing should be up 24% today in the middle of a pandemic?
Well, look, you yourself said there's so much premium built into the options, but the thing's so volatile that if you're patient, it doesn't matter. So I'm not surprised. You know, if it was a point where the VIX was at 12 and the Dow was routinely moving 30 or 50 points in a day, I would be like, all right. But, you know, I'm not super surprised to see that. But look, I've noticed the days when the exchanges are the indices rather, or the index futures are going up, and Tesla holds firm and can't catch a bid. I've seen those days too, and I've seen the opposite. You know, where the index is plunging and you know. So, I don't really know.
At least he filed an 8K. Let's give him credit.
There you go. That's a good start. So, we'll have to see. What's baffling to me is, and I had this conversation a couple days ago, that people are surprised by this. I mean, what I thought the move from 600 down to 400 here, was over the last couple of weeks, was everybody, you know, I know that this stock doesn't follow fundamentals, but everybody, quote unquote, discounting an eventual shutdown anyway. And so then to see it, you know, off 8% here after hours, like it's some big surprise that they had to shut down. The whole fucking world's shutting down. Like, and the other thing too is this guy's not getting a bailout. If this guy gets a bailout, I will fucking lose my mind. All right. This guy has already pissed away billions of dollars in taxpayer money, all to run this business that has never turned an annual profit. Okay. There's no bailout for him. You got $6 billion in the bank, and you got to make it work. So what do you do?
Oh, he's getting a bailout.
You think?
Prepare yourself. I mean, this guy is a subsidy truffle hound, unlike unlike anything we've ever seen. And look at Bill de Blasio on Twitter today. Give me a break. The mayor of New York, in the middle of an exponentially growing outbreak in his city, is tweeting Elon Musk about making ventilators. You think that this guy, and you know what? He's going to take all of those employees and walk up to the table and say, hey, Mr. Trump, you know, okay, if you do that, don't mind the private jet over here. You know, all these jobs are going to be at risk. You know, maybe we could pivot away from Tesla, but it's a fascinating thing. So what does a bailout mean? In my mind, a bailout means you wipe out the equity.
Yeah.
So I for the sake of the employees and the brand and the customers that like the cars, and the customers genuinely like the cars. There's just no denying that. And some of the technology is good and interesting. It's not worth four times revenue, but you know, do I want to see anybody lose their job at Tesla? Absolutely not. Does the equity need to be at $400 a share if he's going to get a bailout? Absolutely not. That's not the way the world works. It's called cap tables, right? Like, if Boeing needs a bailout, the U.S. can decide that having a domestic aerospace industry is strategically important. It doesn't mean that the equity of Boeing should be anything greater than zero.
Right.
Boeing can exist with a new cap structure where the equity gets wiped out. The outgoing CEO had a fiduciary to the equity and he failed. There has to be consequences. If there are no consequences, then people will just do what they want and understand that if they have enough employees, they can walk to any negotiation they want with a suicide vest on and say, you better pay me, you better be on the out, or else I'm going to blow up all these jobs. That's not how capitalism works. We're in a very dangerous time in our country. The manner in which we handle the bailouts that are going to be coming,
right,
is going to define the country for the next 20 years.
Yeah, I agree. Sure. And that's why, sorry, I was just having a sip of my brandy.
No worries.
I agree. That's why when Shamath was on today, who I disagree with on everything all the time, and was saying, you know, no stock options, we have to wipe the equity, CEOs have to be held accountable, I agree with him 100%, because at the end of the day, it boils down to this. Yes, this virus is an existential event that nobody predicted, nobody, you know, whatever, came out of nowhere, and that's correct. But if you're responsibly managing a business and you are responsible with your capital, you are prepared for this. And I tweeted out yesterday, you know, Suze Orman always tells people, before you do anything, make sure you have a 6-month emergency fund. And I'm like, can we get her in front of the fucking CEOs of some of these companies? Because every one of these executive teams managed their companies incorrectly. They did a terrible job. They levered up. They bought back stock with all their free cash flow, right? And now, you know, people say, oh, well, we can't do it because the employees will lose their jobs. That outrage should be directed at the executives that made these decisions, okay? And you have to wipe the equity if you're gonna bail them out. You have to. And you can't allow these guys to buy back stock again, and you can't allow them to reissue options and warrants and restructure their salary. There has to be real consequences for the executives, and the workers are the people that really need the bailout. The workers are the people that need the capital injection. It's the workers. I mean, it's not some guy's fault on some assembly line somewhere at, you know, United Airlines, the baggage handler. It's not his fucking fault that the executives in the C-suite pissed away all their free cash buying back their stock at 25 times earnings. You know, that guy needs the bailout. The executives can just fuck right off, okay?
Yeah, but they already wrote off with their, I mean, that's the part that's infuriating is, and you know, believe me, I'm a capitalist, but you know, you want to know why Elizabeth Warren has a voice. You want to know why AOC has a voice. You want to know why Bernie Sanders is a phenomenon. To the people that I know in the executive suite and people I know on Wall Street, this is the biggest threat to capitalism. I, you know, I'm all for free market, but I mean, this, look at Boeing. Like, okay, what if you are, as you said, you're a responsible company. You didn't lever up your balance sheet. You didn't buy back stock. You didn't waste away all your money on dividends. And now you're ready for this. And your competitor is going to the public trough to get bailed out. I mean, what? So this company doesn't need to bail out because they're responsible. So de facto, they're going to be punished. So all of this basically means we're heading into a very complex, undefined, critically important period in our history.
Yeah.
As a country. And I said on Twitter the other day, this is what really scares me. The number of pigs at the trough is going to very quickly vastly exceed the size of the trough.
Oh, hell yeah.
Which means this. It means this. It means it's going to immediately become very political. Right? And the speed of our politics is slower than the speed of the liquidity drain we're all looking at. And I'm not optimistic.
Well, we're going to lose a lot of companies. I mean, that's just the reality of things. And the ones that we don't lose, they're going to nationalize, which is another terrible idea. So you got all, you have a bunch of very, very bad roads to go down here. You know,
100%.
People don't realize too, you know, bankruptcy, look, if United Airlines goes bankrupt, that doesn't mean that flights are going to stop. Doesn't mean that,
it means,
you know,
the equity's wiped out.
Right.
And the bondholders pick up the pieces.
Exactly. That's it. The flights still go, you know, while they restructure the business. And then you have a management team that comes in and does what the last management team didn't do. They, you know, are responsible with their cash. They have a capital buffer. They do the, you know, so bankruptcy is not the worst thing in the world. Bankruptcy happens for a reason. And, you know, when it comes down to between that and nationalizing industry, I mean, we're turning into Japan, but like, we arguably we could be worse. And like you're saying, it's a very interesting balancing act because you have to print such an egregious amount of money in order to conduct these bailouts. And like you said, every fucking person left and right with a business anywhere is going to be lining up trying to get bailed out. That, you know, it becomes political because we got to pick and choose. But also you start teetering on the, you know, how much money can we print? How much can we inject into the economy? And what are the long-term consequences of that?
Yeah, and it also looked, I'm not saying it's easy, and I'm not saying that this is, like, there's no playbook for what, you know, Raul and, you know, the Real Vision team have been calling that the sky is falling, and a few others have made some pretty robust calls out there, and so far I think they're right. For example, just one small consequence, if we wipe out all the equity, what happens to the pension crisis in the country? It doesn't get better.
Right.
And so, ultimately, if you sort of walk through the logic and the dominoes, it's hard to get around a debt jubilee. Like, how do we not have one? Which means, basically, this sort of giant societal reset might be upon us. And I don't know, it's scary. Like, I'm – look, don't get me wrong. I don't want to be, you know, a big doom and gloom person. But you and I were both amongst others. We're pretty early on this. And it's – if you just think about how fast things have moved in the last 7 days and then project forward for the next 3 weeks, it's scary, man. Like, I'm not – believe me, as much as I might be a doomer and a prepper and I feel like I've prepared my immediate family and friends well, this is not good. This is not good. This is not a happy time, you know, and it's going to be an interesting time. Now, look, I mean, if we're going to print – I do think all roads lead to printing our way out of it, so the stock market could race in nominal terms.
Right, in nominal terms.
Yeah, in nominal terms. Currency debasement. But then, you know, the counter arguments are, you know, QE is deflationary. And if you look, the single best trade I made this year, I was like 20, 25% in gold, and I sold everything at 1370 on the Fizz, which was probably around 1670 or 1330 on the Fizz, which is what I buy, the symbol is PHYS. I have a really good friend, Tony Greer, who runs TG Macro, and he was screaming at me, you know, TC, in a crisis, gold is just another thing that gets sold.
Right.
And I believed him, and I liquidated all my gold at 1670, I think it was. It's, you know, sometimes selling at a profit is the best trade you can make.
Sure.
And I just parked all that stuff in cash. And I'm a loyal and lifelong subscriber to his newsletter now, after that one call basically made me, you know, many decades worth of expense on his newsletter, which is, I think, quite good. And so, you know, I don't know what happens when we go into the abyss. You know, it's kind of like physics, there's this thing called
gold is going to tear on the back end of this. Like, it is maybe. It's going to continue to get smacked. It will continue to get smacked. But when the, you know, because it's very easy to liquidate. But also you got to look at, you know, where are we today? We closed maybe 1475, 1500, somewhere around there. I didn't look, but you know, it's still up over the last, 18 month period. Definitely number one, you know, very easy to liquidate. And on the tail end of this, I think we're through 2000 by the end of the year, because I think we get a therapeutic. I think that even if life has changed, things start to normalize. So the feeling of volatility and panic goes down a little bit. And then people look to see exactly how much money we've printed worldwide, not just our capital bank, our central bank rather, but other central banks around the world. And yeah, go ahead.
Couple points. I didn't sell any of my physical. Let's be clear. I sold my paper gold.
Right.
I think we're seeing huge spreads between physical and paper.
Mm-hmm.
And I just think they're completely different products. You know, I had Grant Williams on our podcast early on. He's gracious enough to lend us his name and credibility by joining us on the podcast. And I think physical gold is completely and utterly separate from the trading vehicle. And I view, you know, GLD and FIS as nothing more than trading vehicles to express what I think the crowd is thinking about.
Right.
On a go-forward basis.
You can't even buy physical right now. You can't buy silver. Correct. Either. Everywhere that I buy from, three different dealers are sold out of everything.
You can't buy mine. And it's and it's in the safe next to my Glock. But the second point that I wanted to make is you and I are buying gold quoted in U.S. dollars. And right. I do think amongst the currencies, you know, the U.S. dollar could be shaping up for a pretty big bull run here. I'm personally short the euro in size. I just think if we're truly heading into the abyss, sort of the U.S. dollar is the one and only king dollar trade is upon us, I believe. And it's not my idea, you know, I'm not recommending it, and you and I never give investment advice, and you'd be stupid to take investment advice from us. But I do think that, you know, gold as quoted in U.S. dollars may or may not necessarily run in the next 3 to 6 months.
Sure, you might be right. And I think there's a chance that people pile into the dollar also. You know, I saw Real Vision, the guy from Real Vision, talking about this last night. Because, you know, everybody could just pile into the dollar. And, you know, we've got these swap lines out there now, so we're making dollars easy to get for every other central bank. I don't necessarily disagree with you, but my outlook, you know, on gold, especially the physical gold, also conveniently located next to several of my firearms, is an outlook, you know, it's a multiple decade outlook. It's not a 3 to 6 month outlook.
So here's a chart that I like to look at a lot, which is actually making all-time highs right now, which is the gold to oil ratio, where you basically take out the dollar from the denominator of both.
Mm-hmm.
If you divide the price of gold by the price of oil, it's higher than it's ever been. Now, that means two things. You should either go long oil and short gold and play that arbitrage.
Right.
Or society is redefining the value of those two assets, which is sort of what the Tesla people would say. Oil is becoming less useful and gold is becoming infinitely more useful as we head into this crisis.
Yeah, so you have a odd period here too, right? Yeah. Where oil has collapsed.
It's historic, Chris. It has never been higher by a lot.
Yeah.
The gold to oil ratio today, if you just take $1,525, you know, and you do the math, it's high.
Yeah.
Right. It's 60. historic previous high, I think, was like 45. Now, just because the gold-to-oil ratio is 60 doesn't mean it can't go to 90, and I wouldn't put that trade on because you can get your face ripped off.
Right.
But I'm just looking at it and thinking to myself, is oil less useful on a go-forward basis, and is gold more useful? And what does that mean? Because that's an interesting thing. Or are we just at a point where oil is so beaten down and the panic is so high in the financial system that, you know, there's a fine line between that generational trading opportunity and getting your face ripped off because you're making a big bet, stepping into a tsunami. Yeah. And I don't know. It's an interesting time for sure. Historic time, you know.
Yeah, well, and new, you know, unprecedented paths that we're going down as a society, as a nation, could lead to unprecedented outcomes in something like, you know, the gold to oil ratio. I mean, that ratio may not be the end all be all. It may go to 180. You know what I mean? I don't feel like the Saudis and the Russians want to play ball. I feel like they're going to continue to flood the market. I feel like it's a concerted effort to put U.S. shale producers out of business and to make a statement. And, you know, right now we're dealing with an existential crisis and printing more money than we ever have ever. So we don't
really
know.
Potentially less money than all of the other shirts in the closet. So mm-hmm. I don't know. A lot of moving parts. So it's certainly interesting. Why don't we chat about the virus and what freaked you out so early? And you know, I know you've boldly gone out on social media to some controversy very early on. As you said, you know, you basically thought that at Trump's 15 going to zero press conference, he assured that he was going to lose. What made you freak out so early? And maybe I could tell you what I saw from my vantage point.
This is like the scene in Office Space where the Bobs all of a sudden are interviewing Bill Lumber. Now.
Well, I am a podcast host. You know,
the camera turns around. You know, it's just like, how many hours a week would you say you spend on these TPS reports, Bob?
Yeah.
Well, what freaked me out about it early, as everybody already knows, so I'm not going to go completely into depth about it, is I don't trust China. I've worked with U.S.-listed China-based companies for half a decade and helped expose a lot of fraud in the space. A company that I worked for was featured in a movie called The China Hustle. If you can find it, it's out there. And it's a great film to watch. It's got guys like Carson Block and a bunch of other people that were involved in helping expose a bunch of fraud in the U.S.-listed China-based reverse takeovers some years back, some of which still persists. In doing that, I worked with a lot of Chinese nationals. I felt like I got a pretty good pulse as to what things are actually like in China without ever being there, and what the ethos of the Chinese government is, and kind of how shrewd they are when it comes to business, how important the optics are to them. And knowing all of those things and starting to see little pieces of data trickling out of China in January, I was immediately worried. When you combine that, my initial worries were it was much worse there than they were letting on because the response was incongruent with the numbers that they were giving. And additionally, my worries were skepticism surrounding the nature of the virus, most of which have been quelled at this point. I'm not especially convinced, since so many people outside of China have had a chance to review it, that the virus is anything, that it's not some lethal weapon that I thought maybe it could have been. It's certainly very dangerous, but I've laid off that a little bit. So in seeing that, and then at the same time looking at the lack of action that we were taking as this was unfolding, you know, if you sit in front of a terminal and you watch the headlines break all day, every day, you're pretty up to date on the news. And while politicians were busy dealing with the impeachment and Trump was playing golf, this was spreading, and at a time when we should have been acting, and we should have been cutting off flights, we should have been taking precautions and doing the things that we're doing now 2 months ago, we weren't doing it. And I also think that people were blindsided to the degree where they don't really understand the nature of a virus. Every other problem they've had is one that they can explain, they can see with their eyes, they can push away with money, and this is the opposite of that. You can't see it spread. You don't know it's at your doorstep. You can't print enough money to make it go away. It exists in the biological realm, not in the, you know, human kind of ethnocentric realm where we're the center of the universe. It doesn't give a fuck about us, our stock market, our economy, who dies, who lives. It is what it is. All of those things together have me very worried, sounding the alarm very early in January, calling people that I knew, you know, telling people at the bars that I went to, hey, you're not going to see me after so-and-so a date. Hey, make sure you're out and prepared. And I was given basically a giant collective fuck you by everybody that I spoke with the exception of my parents, who are lovely people, and listened to me. What about you?
I'd say similar, although I'll give you a different angle. I have a fair amount of experience in China from my time as an executive. I traveled there multiple times a year for the better part of a decade. And I have a pretty good understanding of China relative to the average person. I'm not a China expert. No think tank would hire me.
Right.
but I have a model for observing and consuming news out of China, which is the one and only thing that drives all behavior of the Chinese Communist Party is the preservation of the China Communist Party.
Right, exactly.
And what freaked me out was very clearly, very early, like I got lots of friends in China that I text on a regular basis that I've gotten to know, people that used to work for me, people I used to work for, colleagues. Early on, the China Communist Party decided it was better to crater their economy than to let this virus go unchecked. And that means to me that the Chinese Communist Party thought that the threat from the virus was a bigger threat than completely and totally shutting down their economy for multiple weeks at a time.
Right. Yep.
And I'm a big believer in, I observed, you know, I grew up in a bit of a, you know, a bit of a rough upbringing. And I think my street smarts come from my survival instinct of getting out of how I grew up and achieving some success in life. I'm a firm believer, and I observe actions. I don't really listen to words, except I listen to the words and compare them to the actions, which is itself another data point. And the actions of the Chinese Communist Party at the beginning of this outbreak, and well, the beginning of the response to the outbreak in January, the outbreak I think started in late November, early December, when the history is written, we'll know, they really freaked me out. And you don't shut down a city of 10 million people
exactly.
And basically you cordon off a whole province of tens of millions of people, start welding in people's doors, shut down the whole economy. I mean, it went from 100 to zero. Let's be clear
exactly.
What happened.
Exactly, yep.
And I'm thinking to myself over here in North America, like, whoa, this is a big deal. And we're all just, you know, going to the beach and thinking everything's great. Stock market's making an all-time high every day. That's when I started prepping. I mean, I'm a prepper by nature, and I very much believe in individual rights and preparedness and being responsible for your own family and, you know, buying a little bit of insurance for any unexpected outcomes. I never in my wildest dreams imagined that we would be sitting here on day seven of a self-imposed quarantine because of a global pandemic. But when I saw the Chinese Communist Party sacrifice their national economy, which they take very big pride in, and is a foundation brand of capitalism, works better than the West, and we are an economic miracle, and so on. When President Xi decided that was worth sacrificing to get a handle on this virus,
right?
That's when I went into go mode. And I remember, and you and I were texting at the time, being in Home Depot in late January, wondering where the crowd was.
Mm-hmm.
And now when I see people, you know, lined up around the block at Costco, it's worrying and at the same time sort of strangely gratifying is the wrong word, but validating
right.
Of our early desire to prepare. It's weird how in this country prepper is a bad word and preparedness is viewed as almost prepper and conspiracy theorist are almost the same word. I wonder why that is. It's so weird to me.
Because we got a bunch of dumb motherfuckers that don't think for themselves. Next question.
Yeah, could be. Or you've got a few extreme folks, you know, like I'm not one of these. I don't have, you know, 200,000 rounds of ammo. And I've you know, but I got enough food to last for a fair amount of time. I think about, here's the thing. I view my household as, let's just call it a business. Here's the model. My product is the health and well-being of my family and especially my children.
Right.
Why would I run a just-in-time inventory model when the consequences of destocking is catastrophic?
Right. Exactly.
It makes no sense to me. Like, by the way, all the stuff I bought to be ready for this quarantine, I could last several months if we never left the house. I'm going to eat all that. I got to drink all that. All I did was take cash and put it into inventory. You're trying to tell me that the inventory reval isn't going to help my P&L this quarter? I mean, all the stuff I bought. By the way, I have a friend who has an at-risk relative, and we just mailed them some masks that I bought 4 years ago. I wasn't out trying to get masks now with the crowd. I think ahead, and you know, I have some boxes of latex gloves, and I have some medical grade masks if we needed it. I have water. I have water filters. I have food.
You were the guy that told me to get water filters. Actually,
yeah,
we actually were texting about this really early on. You and I forgot.
You don't think I could?
You text me one day, and I was already in Walmart.
Yeah,
and it was that same deal. It was like late January, and what I was doing was, when I was freaked out by what China was doing, like what you're saying, I just started making daily trips. I was like, every day, I'm just going to get a little bit more. And I was telling my parents, do the same thing. And as I'm going, I'm taking inventory with my eyes, and I'm watching the mannerisms of people that are walking around. At first, it was everything was in stock, and everybody was going about business as usual. As the days progressed, people looked up. I was noticing more people in certain aisles. I was hearing from people, oh, you're not the first person that's asked for that. I was, you know, it was so strange to watch it happen. And I mean daily. I was basically buying stuff daily. If I wasn't at the hardware store, I was at the food store. If I wasn't at the food store, I was at the liquor store. If I wasn't at the liquor store, I was at Walmart. If I wasn't at Walmart, I was at, you know, Costco. And I forgot I was in Walmart when you texted me that one day and you said, get water filters instead of getting bottles of water. And I was like, fucking A, very good idea. And so now I got water filters.
And by the way, you don't think I could sell those for what I paid for them?
Of course. Well, and this is what I said early on in January in one of my podcasts. I'm like, you know, what's the worst that happens? I got a basement full of fucking garbanzo beans that expire 4 years from now, and I'm going to eat them, you know, in 6 months instead of now. Like, that's a win. You're just shifting assets around on the balance sheet.
100%. And, you know, I do think that one of the potential positive benefits of what I think, I mean, it's a catastrophe. It's at a minimum an economic catastrophe. I pray every day it's not a health catastrophe. Is I do think this concept of thinking about beyond just-in-time delivery, you know, we sacrifice a lot of resilience and robustness for efficiency. You know, all of these companies that are at the trough now looking for a bailout listened to their McKinsey consultants and thought they could optimize by issuing debt and, you know, maybe get a half a point on the cost of capital down. And, you know, and by the way, you could buy back stock and juice your own options.
Overclocking themselves by one millionth of a, you know, of a nanosecond, right?
And so, but there's no question. I think Ben Hunt has been the most right on this and the most loud on this. You know, the management class, upper middle management of corporations in the country have done I think it's a scandal. You know, almost all of the free cash flow, certainly majority of the free cash flow has gone to buying back stock to basically negate, stock options and awards awarded to management. And because of GAAP accounting, you know, and you know, adjusted EBITDA, and you look at Tesla, you know, share-based compensation is a huge part of their expense, and it's all just basically continuously diluting the shareholders. Now, they don't do stock buyback because they don't produce cash, because they destroy economic value with every transaction, but that's a whole different story. But in aggregate, we've had an enormous transfer of wealth to the management class via the shareholder buyback, and now that's all coming home to roost, and they're all looking for bailouts. Like, why should it is what it is. You know, they're too big to fail in aggregate, and they knew it, and they took advantage of it.
Not only that, but at this point, the SEC is loosening regulations on small businesses under the guise of, hey, we need to give these businesses some breathing room. So they are not requiring audits now from companies that are, I think, under a certain couple hundred million dollars in market cap, which is going to allow a bunch of frauds to continue to perpetuate. And I saw today that FASB is asking for accounting changes too. It's like, that's not going to help. Like, sometimes you just gotta eat shit. You know, you guys made a bunch of dumbass decisions, and sometimes the chickens come home to roost. You can't keep moving the goalposts and moving the end zone to try to couch the blow.
Yeah, I like how we're always careful to say this is not investment advice. I'm sitting here laughing. I'm just like, what the hell's Jay Clayton going to do about it?
Well, yeah. I mean, certainly don't
I mean, come on. If Elon Musk can ignore an order from a sheriff, you know, they probably would come down on us because we have, you know, the audacity to point out the truth.
Well, when you see like a PR about somebody getting busted for insider trading, it's like
$50,000.
Yeah, some peckerhead that made like $3,000, you know, somewhere. His dentist tipped him off to a M&A and he put, you know, put his entire $4,000 account into it or something. But
yeah, it's crazy. You know.
Meanwhile, Dick Fold is on a boat right now getting blown by some Eastern European hooker. You know, drinking a $10,000 bottle of champagne. Can't say that one enough. You know, it's just, it's a sad, sad world that we live in. Anything else that you want to touch on before we split?
I think we've, what higher note to end on than Dick Fold?
Yeah, exactly. And if you're listening, Mr. Fold, congratulations. You know,
you did. Who's the idiot?
Exactly. Exactly. All right, Mr. Charts, will you come on again soon, my brother?
Absolutely. It's been a lot of fun. I super, very much appreciate it. And, you know, if you ever want to have a long sit down and talk about Chris Irons, the man, you got an outlet with us anytime you want it.
Yeah, let's do it, man. Whenever you're ready, we'll line it up. Brother. All right, brother?
Appreciate it.
All right, talk to you soon. That was the one, the only Mr. Tesla Charts himself from his underground bunker, wherever that is. Not really sure. It's confidential information. Last thing I'm going to mention, patrons, from now until tomorrow at midnight, tomorrow is Friday, March 20th, I'm matching 50% of all patrons going to the Center for Philanthropic Disasters or Center for Disaster. I've had some brandy, folks. It's going to a coronavirus charity, and that's all you need to know. Please, if you ever considered being a patron, it's a super dope time to do it. It will all be going to a good cause, and I've had some wonderful people looking to make a donation of at least a couple $100 here already. I will post that on my Twitter tomorrow. But for right now, I am the fuck out. Peace.